Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine a spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk in the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host and my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity. And good evening, everyone. Again, it's Donna. And on today's show, we're so happy to bring you a very important topic having to do with sexual abuse and the disabled and other marginalized populations, and an update on a very important case as well. Anna, if you may remember, was on an initial show when Shattered Lives was in its infancy. We're almost a year old here, and we're very glad to have her back. She is the Director of Public Policy and Communications for the Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services, Inc., and does a very good job at her duties. And tonight she has given us a full plate menu of many issues for us to discuss. And so I want to say welcome, Delilah. Thanks so much for minding this door, so to speak. Glad to have you with us. And Anna, thanks for coming out a second time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. And hi, Delilah.
Hi. I'm here. I'm back. I'm here running the switchboard. Hopefully we have a lot of listeners this evening, because this is an extremely important topic, and especially to all of the women in America. And I think that Anna addresses it very, very well, considering the notes that she sent. I know she's going to give us a lot of very good information, and I'm ready to hear it.
Yes, certainly, and I am too. Anna, can you just to start out with, in case people didn't happen to tune into the first show, can you give us a one or two sentence intro with respect to CONSACS and what you do?
Sure. Connecticut Sexual Assault Crisis Services, which we abbreviate as CONSACS, is the statewide coalition of Connecticut's 9 local community-based sexual assault crisis services programs. Those 9 programs provide services to victims and survivors of sexual violence and their loved one in every city and town throughout Connecticut. They provide 24/7 hotline services, crisis counseling and intervention, hospital accompaniment, court and police accompaniment, and all those services are free and confidential. And then as the coalition, CONSACS represents those 9 local programs on the statewide level. So we serve as the voice for those 9 programs at the state capitol, and then in statewide policy and advocacy conversations.
I see. So you have your hand in many of those different entities, because you are the public policy and communications person, correct?
Correct. We try to formulate our legislative agenda each year based on the feedback that we receive from advocates in those 9 programs. They're doing such important, amazing work every single day. So we listen to them. We listen to the victims and survivors that we serve, and we ask, you know, what's going on? What are you seeing day to day that needs to change, that could be better? And then we take those mm-hmm. ideas and try to formulate them into policy initiatives that then we take to legislators and that hopefully eventually become law.
Well, that sounds like a good model, because you're right there at the grassroots level, and then you take it and you bring it where it needs to be. So that's wonderful. I think for us to start out with, as you know, a few months ago there was a very celebrated case, and maybe celebrated isn't the right word, but Richard Fortin was a sexual predator, and he happened to be a caretaker of a severely developmentally disabled woman. And my understanding is from writing a blog several weeks ago, he had been convicted, but then due to a loophole in the law, he did not get his just punishment, shall we say. And at that time, everyone was in an outrage, including myself. And I know that it was your hope to bring it to the legislature again, and the legislature has just convened. And this is a long session, gratefully, with everything else going on in Connecticut with the Sandy Hook mass murders and whatnot, that they're going to need this time. But with respect to this particular case, I know that you've gone to the legislative office building and tried to address this issue before. So I'm hoping that maybe this will be the time when this can be addressed. And so could you please give us an update with regard to that case and what you would like to do legislatively and what you project for the future?
Sure. So this case, State v. Fortin, we found out about it a handful of years ago when the appellate court first overturned the guilty verdict in the case, and the state Supreme Court upheld that appellate court decision in October of this year. So the problem, the loophole that you mentioned in the case, had to do with how state statute defines the term physically helpless, because Richard Fortin was initially convicted and sentenced based on the idea that he had committed an act of sexual assault against a woman who was physically helpless. Because the victim in this case needs care for most of her aspects of daily living, she's unable to communicate verbally. She can only communicate using a speech board and just this really laborious process of gesturing. But the appellate court and then the state Supreme Court said, well, you know, we sent this guy to jail on the basis because the prosecutors argued that this woman was physically helpless and therefore was not in a position where she could communicate her lack of consent to sexual contact. But the court had to answer this question of what does it actually mean to be physically helpless? Right now, statute says that you're physically helpless if you're unconscious or for any other reason physically unable to communicate unwillingness to an act. And the court said, well, yeah, the communication board wasn't present during the assault. She's unable to verbally communicate, but this victim's capable of biting and kicking and scratching, and she didn't bite or kick or scratch the assailant. So they said, you know, basically she could have, there were
saying hypothetically she could have done those things.
Correct. So
was she in a position physically to do that? Did she have athetoid CP or spastic CP or anything like that? Where she didn't she weren't her limbs contorted as well?
I know that she had some form of cerebral palsy that made it very that makes movement difficult. So
right.
I mean, if you can imagine a situation where any person, whether they have a disability or not, is very fearful and being attacked.
Right.
So as a person who doesn't have a disability, I can't imagine being comfortable biting an offender or kicking or scratching. So many victims and survivors in that moment, in that circumstance, just do what they have to do to survive. And
right.
I think, you know, this idea that a person could be reasonably expected to communicate using biting or scratching while they're being sexually assaulted is
right.
it just doesn't make sense. So,
no,
you know, so that's
Anna,
a problem.
Anna,
yeah,
I have a question. How do you think, how would this conviction have come down had this person not been physically disabled? How would the court or the jury judge have ruled in this had the victim not been physically disabled? So there's what I'm asking, I guess, is are they setting the bar for all sexual assault cases like this, or is this only ruled because of the fact that this victim was physically disabled?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. And
good question.
A question that we've had to really think about as we've thought through. You know, we know that this is a problem, but how do we want to fix it? so we, you know, we one of the things that we started looking at was, you know, was there, could the prosecutors have charged this case differently? Because there are laws that protect, you know, in theory at least, that protect all of us from any kind of unwanted sexual contact. But, you know, in this particular case, it would have been really difficult to try to argue that there was a level of violence. I mean, the victim wasn't, I mean, all sexual assault is an injury, but there wasn't, you know, any evidence of, you know, physical violence. There wasn't a weapon used. So the way that the law was written was meant to cover a situation where you have somebody who's not able to fight back. So I think if the victim had been somebody who did not have a disability, there's still a lot of difficulties in prosecuting sexual assault crimes to begin with. I'm not an attorney or a prosecutor, so it's kind of hard for me to speak to some of those particular issues. But in these cases where I almost hate to use the phrase, but people think of them as these sort of he said, she said cases where the victim mm-hmm. says, you know, I said I didn't want this. And the offender says, well, yes, you wanted this. You said you did. You know, and that's something that's very hard for prosecutors to charge. And that's something that's very hard to play out in a courtroom. So the way that we thought, you know, up until this court decision that the law was set up was to say, you know, it really is a special circumstance when people are physically or mentally not in a position to communicate or to, you know, physically confront their offender.
Right.
That was kind of a long answer. I'm not sure if it got to exactly what you were saying, but I mean, in any case, these are very difficult crimes to charge and to prosecute, and you know, because there's so much violence against people mm-hmm. with disabilities, the law, we thought, you know, really had this extra special protection built into it.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that he was her caretaker, isn't that supposed to be a special relationship, a trusting relationship, and one that, you know, I don't know if he was her caretaker for a long period of time, and then all of a sudden this occurred, or maybe there was abuse going on, you know, for an extended period of time and no one discovered it or whatnot. But does being a caretaker somehow up the ante in terms of the degree of the crime?
Yes and no. I don't think he was a formal, like, payrolled caretaker. He was,
yep.
I believe at the time, the boyfriend of
the
survivor's mother.
Yeah.
You know that a lot of people with disabilities have an informal network of caretakers,
right.
Some of whom, you know, maybe provided, you know, kind of on a professional level. And then there are also a lot of family members and friends and acquaintances who also contribute to a person's care. So in this
right.
case, you know, he wasn't in a formal caretaker position.
Uh-huh.
There are laws that would protect certain client-patient relationships.
Right.
But because he wasn't in a formal
paid caretaker,
authority.
Yeah. So what's going on? What do you plan to do legislatively with it, and what do you foresee, given the legislative climate with the other things that are happening in this state and across the nation now with the Newtown mass shootings?
So with this piece of legislation in particular, our goal is to amend the definition of physical helplessness to encompass any physical or mental disability that makes it, you know, impossible or very difficult for a person to communicate their lack of consent or to physically resist an attacker.
With a very strict definition, like detailed definition, so there's no room for misinterpretation, shall we say?
Correct. You know, the challenge has been we want it to be broad enough to apply to situations like the Fortin case where
right.
You sort of intuitively say, oh, well, that really seems wrong. And, you know, we want in those cases, we want perpetrators to be held accountable. But it's a really fine line because we also don't want language that's so broad that it applies to, you know, all disabilities in general in such a way that we're criminalizing consensual sexual contact
right.
with people with disabilities.
I understand. Fine line there.
So we've been working really hard for the last 4 years now with the Office of the Chief State's Attorney. We have some great prosecutors that have helped us with the language. We've been working with the Office of Protection and Advocacy, the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, the ARC of Connecticut. We just have these really great invested partners who, you know, have helped us craft the language and, you know, from my
mm-hmm.
perspective, have really helped me understand you know, some of the issues within the disability community that we need to keep in mind when crafting this language. So I think we have good language. The Judiciary Committee, I've met with both of the co-chairs, and they're both very supportive. They want to do this session. They want to do it right. They want to help make sure that that we have language that not only solves the problem, but language that's going to not result in more court cases. We want the language to be so good that it's going to stand up to future challenges. You know, when you have the next
mm-hmm.
Wharton case that somebody brings along
right.
and, you know, tries to get out based on a loophole, we don't want those loopholes to exist anymore.
Right. So you're confident that with crafting the very good language that you have and the support of the co-chairs of the judiciary, that this ultimately will pass this session?
I'm very hopeful. Nothing's ever a given. But you know, there's so much commitment and so much amazing public support around this issue at this point that I feel, you know, I feel better about this issue than I've ever felt about it before, and I think we're really close to making this change happen.
That's great. Yeah, one last question about this, and then we're going to go on to one of other many topics that we have. Will that affect what happened with Fortin retroactively at all, or no?
No, there's actually precedent from the U.S. Supreme Court that says you can't retroactively apply certain changes around criminal statutes. So you can't go back and say, oh, this thing you did 6 years ago, now it's a crime.
Too bad.
And,
too
so
bad.
As much as it, you know, sometimes it would be nice, but, you know, it would also be problematic.
Right. I understand.
You know, for people to be able to make laws to say, you know, that haircut you had when you were 13, that was criminal, you know, and to retroactively apply laws that way. So I understand why that's there,
yeah,
but
I understand that, yeah. Well, let's move on to one of the other many topics here, and then we're going to come back. I love the idea that we can talk about many different marginalized groups, including people with disabilities, because, as you know, I'm also a member of that group and feel strongly about it. But we have other groups as well. But I also want to talk about the Violence Against Women Act. And because one of our former colleagues who's no longer with us, Susan Murphy Milano, I think was active with respect to that. Maybe Delilah can speak to that. But can you give us a primer with respect to what it is and what has been done thus far, Anna?
Sure. So the Violence Against Women Act is a piece of federal legislation that was initially passed in 1994. It's been reauthorized a couple of times since then. It's one of the most important pieces of legislation federally when it comes to domestic violence, sexual abuse, stalking and other forms of violence, not just against women, but against men as well. VAWA is a really important funding source. There's a lot of funding that comes through this Violence Against Women Act that goes to states for domestic violence shelters, for sexual assault coalitions, for programs and services that benefit victims and survivors. It hasn't had any problems with reauthorization ever before in its almost 20-year history, but the legislative climate is just so contentious and so polarized in Washington right now that last year when it came time to reauthorize VAWA again, it turned into this big partisan struggle, and the bill ended up not being reauthorized. So the first for the first time in 20 years, VAWA didn't pass. So we're at a place now.
By a wide margin?
You know, it actually passed the Senate. It passed the Senate with pretty strong bipartisan support. And then it did not, it was a fairly close vote in the House that it didn't pass. The House created its own version of the Violence Against Women Act that did pass. But then the Senate said, well, we're not taking up your version of VAWA, which I think is a good thing because it didn't have a lot of good protections that had been built into the Senate version.
Mm-hmm.
So
what needs to happen at this point?
So at this point, you know, we have a new Congress that just got sworn in, and on Tuesday, Senator Leahy from Vermont and Senator Crapo from Idaho just reintroduced Senate Bill 47, which is a new kind of resurrected version of VAWA. Nationally, you know, there are so many great advocates working on this issue nationwide, and we're hoping that we'll be able to get 60 co-sponsors in the Senate by the end of this month. If you have those 60 co-sponsors lined up, you know, it's a pretty looks pretty good for the bill to the Senate at that point.
So, is there anything in particular that people should do in terms of advocating for it at this point?
Sure. There's a really great website that I check almost every day set up. It's forvawa.org. It's the number 4, VAWA.org. And that's a website that's maintained by the National Task Force to End Sexual and Domestic Violence Against Women. And they're just excellent about providing regular updates and answering questions about what the Violence Against Women Act is, what it does, where it is in the legislative process. So if you go to that website today, forvawa.org, you can see right on the homepage they have an action item, and they give you instructions for how to call the Capitol switchboard, ask for your senator. And then they even have good messaging where they make it really easy to just call and say, you know, I'm a constituent from Hartford, Connecticut. I'm calling to urge you to co-sponsor S-47. Thank you. And that's it. Both of our senators in Connecticut, Senator Blumenthal and Senator Murphy, formerly Congressman Murphy, were both, you know, wonderful supporters of the Violence Against Women Act last year. So we're pretty confident that they'll be great supporters again this year.
Yeah, that's great. Delilah, can you give us a little historical sketch in terms of Susan's involvement with this in the past?
Well, I can tell you this. Susan was a vocal activist, so to speak, with VAWA and also the Lautenberg Act, which she was more involved in. However, I think one of the strongest messages that Susan Murphy Milano would put out there over the last 20 years and even today is that agencies and coalitions and even victims themselves have got to, they've got to have the proper protection in place, no matter what it is, in place regardless of VAWA. Of course, she started her work before, just around the time VAWA came about and even before that. So it wasn't there. And I think if we look over the last 20 years, and there again, this is her opinion as well, what improvements have we seen in the area of domestic violence, sexual assaults? We're looking at a lot of dollars spent on education and awareness, which is very important. Don't get me wrong, and I'm not being critical. However, there aren't a lot of tools that have come about in the last 20 years. And this is where she is really putting the push with the evidentiary abuse affidavit and other things in her books that actually gave the tools to the agencies and to the victims to document this abuse so that it holds up in court, so prosecutions are stronger, so that victims are better protected. And whether we have VAWA or not, this is going to happen. And while we sit back and wait for VAWA to pass, people are dying. People are being assaulted. It's going to still happen. So we can't just sit back as advocates and keep wishing and working for VAWA to happen when, on the other hand, we have all of these victims that are in great need of our help.
Yeah, I so agree with that. I mean, having the legislation is good to have there as a framework, but when it comes down to brass tacks in terms of the everyday meeting the needs on the streets, so to speak, things like the EAA, I think, is so very important. So you are right, and so I'm very glad that, you know, you gave us that perspective.
Well, you know, it's the case, too, if some of these legislators that are debating this issue were in the shelters and in the streets and, in, you know, dodging the bullets for these people, maybe they would have a little different outlook on whether to pass it or not, or whether this woman deserves it and this one doesn't. I mean, I'm just appalled at some of the excuses they came up with, or some of the issues they came up with to not pass it in the last Congress. It's appalling to me.
Mm-hmm. I think the problem is they're so far removed, and some of those jobs are sort of ivory tower things, and they go and they report there, and they have no connection with what's really going on with the issue that they're voting on, or they're bombarded, and this is not to make an excuse, but it's the reality. They're bombarded with so many bills, and you're lucky if they even glance at it, read it at all before they vote on anything. But, you know, we have to try, and we have to make sure that, you know, those of us that know it's important get behind and tell them, because it's like not voting. If you don't vote, then you're part of the problem. So, you know, what can we do? We're doing the best we can. Let's see, Anna, can you address with us some of the reasons with respect to people with disabilities, but also some of the other marginalized groups, about what the statistics are with regard to sexual violence and why they're so high? What are some of the pervasive fallacies and truths, and, you know, some of the other groups that we made reference to in regard to that? We want to maybe focus the rest of the show on those types of issues, because there's so much to say.
Okay. Yeah, and I'll try to kind of pull that in from the...
We've got like a half an hour. We've got 31
okay.
minutes. Okay. So take it away, Goldie.
We're good. So, you know, I liked the mention of, you know, we need laws that do, you know, really concrete things. And one of the best parts of this new Violence Against Women Act, you know, the one that died last year and that was just reintroduced, is that it does take those steps to provide some really important protections for marginalized communities. You know, in particular, there's some provisions in this new VAWA reauthorization that apply to immigrant women, LGBT populations, and Native American women, because these are communities, you know, much like the disability community, where we see rates of sexual violence, domestic violence, stalking, that are just heartbreaking. I mean, with the disability community, it kind of depends on which statistics you look at and kind of the methodology behind the surveys, but kind of there's this general consensus that if you are born with a disability, your lifetime risk of sexual victimization is double. Just automatically, being born or developing a disability in your lifetime doubles your risk of being sexually assaulted. Within LGBT communities, there's also an elevated risk of sexual assault. You know, there's some studies that show, you know, 52% of gay and lesbian men have experienced an incident of sexual coercion or sexual mm-hmm. assault by same-sex partners. With tribal communities, you know, a third of Native American women are raped in their lifetime, and 40% experience domestic violence. And there are some reservations where we see murder rates of Native women that are 10 times the national average. So,
what's that about?
And can you address the jurisdictional issues with Native Americans? I think the audience needs to understand a little bit about, the facts and the jurisdictions. Who can prosecute on a reservation and who cannot?
Sure, and that's I think that really, in some ways, gets to the point of why we see rates of violence so high, kind of across communities. Native American community is a perfect example of what happens when we push people kind of outside of the protection of the law and when we marginalize communities. The way that the tribal justice system works right now, Native American tribes have jurisdiction on tribal land, but they only have jurisdiction over other tribal members. So if somebody who's not part of the tribe comes onto a reservation and commits a crime, the tribe doesn't have jurisdiction over that crime. That's something that would have to be prosecuted by federal prosecutors. And federal prosecutors, I mean, these are the people who are dealing with, you know, the war on drugs and terrorism and, you know, a lot of really, kind of national security sorts of crimes. So when these reservations contact their federal prosecutors to say, there was somebody from outside of the tribe who came onto the reservation and committed an act of sexual violence. The prosecution rate for those cases, you know, the feds might come and investigate and, take on the case, but it's so just incredibly unlikely that that case is going to go anywhere.
They're just saying it's such a low priority in the scheme of things that they don't bother.
I don't want to say that, you know, it's because that federal prosecutors aren't interested in these crimes. I just think that, you know, they don't have the capacity to pay attention.
Well, also, one of the problems is the fact that most of these reservations are in very isolated areas.
Mm-hmm.
And for a victim to even report the crime to a federal prosecutor, I mean, they may not even have transportation to get the 100 miles they need to. So there's a lot of, you know, there's so much to look at there that is just totally appalling. And
right.
I don't know, this is one that just really gets me going.
Right. No, it should. I mean, it's a mess. And even when you have situations within tribes where one member of a tribe commits a crime against another member, the tribes themselves can prosecute those particular cases, but they're only able to put down sentences that involve a year or less in prison. So, I mean, there's this concept on reservations that doesn't exist anywhere else, where you could have essentially a misdemeanor murder, where, you know, if you have somebody who commits homicide on his reservation, the tribe can take on that case, but they can only hand down a maximum sentence that's
maximum less than a year.
Yeah, that's just so ridiculously low. So it creates a system where, you know, because justice is so fleeting, the offenders know this. Offenders understand that, you know,
And that's not to mention the incredible suicide, alcoholism rate, and poverty that they are plagued with as a population. It all contributes to that in terms of the domestic violence rate. So I think it feeds into itself with all those other things going on.
You just see how these layers and layers of marginalization and oppression start to impact a community. There's no way to separate out one piece of this problem from everything else that's going on. So it's a hard problem to unravel. But
is there resistance, Anna, of the tribal people allowing the federal prosecutors to come in and do their job as well? Is there like animosity there, or is there typically cooperation if something rises to the level of prosecution?
Yeah, you know, I'm not entirely sure, and I imagine that it differs, from one tribal community to another.
Right.
I do know there's been a lot of support amongst Native American communities for certain provisions in this new version of the Violence Against Women Act. There was a lot of some of the tribal coalitions and advocates were very active in helping to come up with solutions that they think would be very helpful to
mm-hmm.
confront the violence in their communities. And part of what they're advocating for is this idea that if you have someone who is not a registered member of a tribal community but who has significant ties to that community, so if they're married to a tribal member, if they live on the reservation, if they're employed by the tribe, that those people, when they commit certain domestic violence and dating violence crimes, would be able to be prosecuted by tribal authorities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
something new.
Sorry?
Yeah. That's something new that
yeah.
that they came up
yeah,
with.
That's something new and something that's sort of ridiculous if you think about it, that if you're not a tribal member, you can be married to a member of the tribe, you can be living on the reservation, but if
mm-hmm.
you commit an act of domestic violence against your native spouse on tribal land, the tribe still can't prosecute you. Even though you're embedded in that community, you have this almost diplomatic immunity where that case is not going to be prosecuted in that community. So
that's pretty incredible.
The tribal coalitions and advocates have said, listen, like this is so easy to change, and this is something that's so important to change. So that's one example of tribes advocating for something that they see will make a difference.
Yeah, that's great. Can you speak to some of the reasons why you articulated them very well in our your policy statement here with regard to some of the perceptions that people with disabilities and maybe other marginalized groups have with respect to why the incidence of sexual violence is so high? I mean, it makes sense to me, but maybe the listeners out there nationally and beyond are not aware, if they don't happen to be a member of a marginalized community or have a disability. Can you speak to some of those reasons as to why sexual assault and sexual abuse is so common among people with disabilities and others?
Sure. Some of the statistics around that, there's research that indicates that about 40% of women with physical disabilities report experiencing sexual violence at some point in their life. And for adults who have developmental disabilities, the numbers just skyrocket. There was one report done in 2000 that indicated that as many as 83% of women with developmental disabilities and 32% of men with developmental disabilities are victims
wow.
of some form of sexual assault during their lifetime. And there are a lot of ideas and research into, why is this possible? That, within this particular segment of the disability community, people with developmental disabilities, what's going on with this? Because
mm-hmm.
It's not an inherent feature of a developmental disability that you would be assaulted. So it must be something about, the culture we create around people with developmental disabilities that allows this
mm-hmm.
to happen. And if you think about it, there's this kind of cultural...
They're very trusting. They are. They're very trusting. Someone in the chat room left a comment that it's very possible that there are a lot of disabled victims who are abused by other persons with disabilities, whether they're developmental probably. So there's also the disabled upon disabled crime that's being committed. And, how do you address something like that?
Well, I think it starts in a lot of ways with information, that there's this perception that a person with a developmental disability isn't going to need to have knowledge about healthy sexuality, that, oh, well, you know, you have a developmental disability, so, you know, there goes your love life.
So you're asexual, we deny
information about body parts, about what it means to have healthy physical interactions with people. You know, when you have a community who, in a lot of ways, is taught to be very compliant, you just kind of to get through the day and to be very trusting of caretakers, of, you know, the people that are providing assistance, that we also, you know, along with that, we need to, it's so important to be teaching boundaries and so important to be teaching vocabulary, that if you create an environment where it's just expected that, you know, oh, well, I've decided that you need help with showering. So, you know, that might be true, but there are ways to do that that still respect a person's boundary, that it shouldn't be okay for somebody providing care to just assume that, you know, it's okay for me to be in your personal space right now. And if we don't teach people that it's okay for them to have a body that belongs to them, and if we don't give them the vocabulary to talk about that body, how can we possibly expect them to first understand when abuse is happening and, you know, then second, have the tools available to describe the abuse that's going on.
Right. And then to know what's good and bad.
Yeah, like I heard one just absolutely heartbreaking story, you know, from a man who has done a lot of work with violence prevention amongst people with disabilities, who said, you know, he provided a training at a group home at one point, and, you know, his training always included just basic information about what to call body parts. And after the training, a woman came up to him and said, you know, someone has been hurting my vagina, which, I mean, this story just makes me so upset every time I remember it. But, you know, that was the first time in this woman's life that she understood and was able to communicate how she'd been being hurt. For years, the same woman at this home had been telling staff, you know, my stomach hurts, I have a stomach ache. And anytime who would come on staff, I mean, she would just very aggressively say, you know, my stomach, like, you know, help me, my stomach hurts. And this woman was punished in the group home because everybody said, you know, she'd gone to all these doctors who said, nothing's wrong with your stomach. You're lying about your stomach. Stop making things up about your stomach. Because
taught her that
there was a part of her body, you know, that her vagina was closer to her stomach than anything else, but no one had ever taught her that word. So,
right.
You know, of course,
that
she's
is very sad.
You know, and she'd say, my stomach, and they'd say, well, you don't have the flu, there's nothing wrong with you, when what she'd been trying to tell all these people was that someone is hurting me, you know, in this very private, personal way. But because she'd been deprived the appropriate vocabulary, that abuse was allowed to continue for years.
Well, in a way, I find that a little bit shocking, because even with little kids where they don't have the vocabulary to describe, they say, well, draw a picture and show me. I mean, if she didn't know what the female genitalia was, it could say, well, show me where it hurts. And maybe she didn't have the physical ability to do that either. I would have maybe, because if you show them, it's definitely differentiating the stomach from a lower area, so to speak.
Or people never provided the opportunity to say, you know, show me. That she
show
thought
me.
She was communicating
right.
very clearly
right.
that, you know, I'm
right.
telling you
My
the part
stomach.
Of me that hurts. But nobody thought, okay, well, show me what that looks like. What, you know, what is that to you?
But this man who did
trainings said, you know, almost every time that he would do one of these presentations, you know, he could just see light bulbs going off, and people would come up to him afterward and say, you know, I didn't know that that was part of my body. Somebody hurt that. You know, nobody ever told me that that's, you know,
wow.
that that's private or that's mine. And, you know, this terrible right. thing has been happening to me. So I think that information piece is so important that we need to, you know, we need to start with this. It's not an assumption, I guess it's a fact that everybody, if they have a disability, no disability, just every single person should have a certain degree of physical autonomy and should understand that their body is their body and that other people need to respect that.
And the privacy and the boundaries, too, regardless of the fact, because, you know, those of us that may need assistance for certain things, or you're sort of on the fence, you have to let people in for certain things, you know, but yet, you know, this is where you draw the line. You don't need them to do this, that, or the other, or you draw the line where you say, okay, maybe I need help washing my back, but I can do all the rest of it, or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, it's just... To me, having worked with people with disabilities all over my life too, it's sort of common sense to say, give them the autonomy that they have, and only intercede when they absolutely need help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You or know? Eddie, even if I know that someone needs assistance washing their back, you know, even if I know that every single time I ask, the answer is going to be, yes, please help me wash my back, you know, you can still take, you have that courtesy to say, you know, do you want this assistance right, you know, right
yes.
now in this moment,
right.
even though it's been okay 1,000 other days for me to help you with this?
Yeah.
You know, because it's still your body today.
It is.
And just because it was okay yesterday, you know, maybe you don't want your back washed today, and you should be allowed to say, you know, no.
Right.
No, I don't.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with what you're saying. You shouldn't force and your assistance on anyone, because that's not what assistance is about. And what about these same issues of sexual assault with some of the other marginalized populations? What would you like to speak a bit about the... Well, we talked some about the Native Americans. How about the LGBT community or some other populations that you might want to talk about sexual violence that maybe we're not aware of in terms of how prevalent it is?
Sure. You know, with the LGBT community, a lot of the violence that we see in that community stems from people in some ways being afraid to reach out for help because they're afraid of being outed. Because,
right.
you know, our society still has so much stigma around, you know, it's getting better, but there's still some families and communities and, you know, our society as a whole really says, you know, it's not okay for you to have a same-sex partner. So
right.
if people experience abuse in that context, you know, they might be thinking, well, I can't, you know, if I call the police, if I tell a friend, if I, you know, go to my family for help, they can't know that I've been dating this person. You know, this causes more problems than it solves. Or there's
right.
this sense of, you know, I can't betray my community. We have to be in this together.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you see groups that have barriers like that, where there's some kind of, when there's some kind of issue that makes people feel unsafe when they seek help, offenders know that, and they can see that, and they can say, you know, this person is going to have a really hard time asking for help when I hurt them.
Right.
It's not the case that, you know, LGBT individuals are inherently, you know, more violent or that they're committing more violence. It's just that offenders within that community are able to do more damage in a way because it's so hard for people to
right.
really get help.
Do you keep data with respect to human trafficking and, you know, sexual assault that has occurred? I know that I heard Commissioner Katz say at the legislative hearing this past week to the legislature that they had identified about 103 people, maybe that's just within the past, I don't know, year or whatnot,
mm-hmm.
that had been trafficked. And with respect to what goes on for sexual violence, is that a piece that CONSACS deals with as well? You interface with the Permanent Commission on the Status of Women with that, or is that a separate entity?
The Permanent Commission, the Status of Women, is a great partner of ours. You know, they're a separate, you know, statewide commission, but they've been really involved in trafficking issues in the past, and we CONSACs and our member programs have been very involved in educating ourselves about what human trafficking and, in particular, sex trafficking looks like, and how we can have services that are helpful and safe for victims of trafficking.
Can you give us a sense of that in Connecticut, just so that people are aware? I mean, here, you know, it happens everywhere, and I think we all have a problem. It's not just in resort communities or, you know, with all the fallacies. Do you have a little bit of an overview with respect to what we're dealing with that here?
You know, I actually don't have great statistics for that in Connecticut. It's really just been the last couple years that the state's changing how it thinks about human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the past, I mean, the numbers look very, very low if you kind of look at the, you know, the formal prosecutions. But what we hear from law enforcement and from providers at DCF is, you know, a lot of people who are being trafficked, they don't turn up in the system as victims of trafficking. They turn up in the system as somebody who is arrested for prostitution,
yeah,
or, you know, somebody who, you know, in the case of people who are trafficked to this country from elsewhere, you know, previously they would just get deported. So that's an area where I think we have started to see more progress, especially in the last 10 years or so, where people are saying, oh, wait, like this person isn't a criminal. This person's the victim of a crime. So what do we do to acknowledge that victimization and to hold people accountable? So I think there have been some really exciting changes, you know, especially in Connecticut in the last probably 5 to 10 years. As far as I know, there still aren't you know, a lot of great statewide numbers and statistics that I've seen.
Right. I don't think so. Now, that kind of brings up the population of immigrant persons, too, as another marginalized group, isn't that right?
Yeah, and you know, similarly to other populations, like, what do you have to lose if you disclose abuse? You know, so within the LGBT community, there are concerns about, you know, outing yourself or outing somebody in your community. And with the disability community, a lot of the abusers are somebody that you really rely on, whether it's a family member or somebody who's providing care. With immigrant communities, there's this barrier that, you know, if you're in this country illegally or if you have, you know, an immigration status that could change or be revoked, it's a big risk to approach the criminal justice system and say, help me out, because these same people that can help you hold an offender accountable are the same people that could have
deported you.
And that, kind of tying it back to the Violence Against Women Act again, there are some good provisions in there about, you know, how do we improve that situation for immigrant victims of violence so that, so it's not this choice that people feel like they have to make a choice between seeking safety and justice when they've been hurt and you know, maintaining their residence here in this country.
Is it a matter of, okay, if you have someone that's here illegally and they're encountering this situation where there's sexual violence, we will not prosecute on the, you know, being here illegally in favor of dealing with the other issue, or with some of the other populations, the same thing. I mean, we're not going to prosecute somebody for being outed, but what I mean is, you know, you just sort of put the other issue aside in favor of dealing with the sexual violence in all of these marginalized populations.
The government's been, you know, trying to deal with that issue within immigrant communities is to make a particular kind of visa called U visas available. So U visas give temporary legal status to certain crime victims, including victims of sexual violence. So if you can show that, you know, you've been a victim of sexual violence and you've suffered substantial mental or physical abuse, you know, there's also this piece where you need to be willing to assist with any criminal investigation. So if you kind of meet that criteria, the government issues up to 10,000 of these visas a year. So that's an example of, you know, one effort to recognize that, oh, hey, you know, if we have no options for a community to feel safe seeking justice, again, if you're a savvy offender, you're going to kind of look out and say, ah, you know, this population here, like, they're not going to go to law enforcement. They're scared to.
Right.
You know, and then you see more and more violence in that community.
Yeah, and that's why they keep going back to those communities. What do you think needs to be addressed, perhaps that has not been looked at? I mean, it looks like they're starting to come up with some good solutions, but with respect to marginalized communities, I mean, is there any particular community that you feel has been totally overlooked, and there's some other issues that you as an organization would like to shine the light on? And kind of another question is, what would be your goals for 2013, Anna?
Oh, well, so our legislative goals for 2013 are to you know, pass this legislation around physical helplessness. And then we're also looking at, you know, this isn't necessarily tied into marginalized communities, but we'd like to see victims of sexual violence be eligible for civil restraining orders. Right now, victims of sexual assault who are assaulted by a stranger, an acquaintance, somebody who's not an intimate partner, they have to wait until there's an arrest in their case before they're eligible for any kind of protective order. So we're hoping to broaden the eligibility for those civil restraining orders, you know, those orders that can be issued before an arrest. And we're also looking at a provision that would allow victims of sexual violence to break a lease without being penalized. So if someone's sexually assaulted on the property of a property that they're renting. So if they're assaulted in their apartment, in the stairway, in the parking garage, and, you know, they have 10 months left on their lease, we're saying that they should be able to give 30 days notice and move without being charged for, you know, penalized in whatever it would cost to break their lease. Because it just seems horrible to think that somebody would have to stay in the apartment for days.
So obvious, so simple, but, you know, again, the law overlooks those situations, so I'm glad you're on top of it. Well, we're very nearly out of time, I'm sorry to say, but please, I would like you to be able to keep in touch with me, and maybe we can continue to report as you go to the legislative office building and testify and keep us up to date on your goals in the Fortin case. Would you do that for me, Anna?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I'd love to.
Good. And, yeah, so maybe we'll even have you on again. But in closing, I want to say, please, and Anna, please do give your website for people.
Oh, our website is www.consacs.org, CONNSACS.org.
Okay, very good. And please visit DonnaGore.com and ImaginePublicity.com to look for upcoming posts in a variety of topics and learn about me, Lady Justice. And it's always appreciated if you share our links. So I want to thank you for joining us on Shattered Lives today. Thank you so much, Anna. Thank you, Delilah. And we look forward to having you all next week. And Godspeed, be safe, and stay warm. Good night.